given. Our next speaker is Otto Scott. He tells me that he's a member of a Scots colonial family, been active in the Caribbean area for the past two centuries. He lives in California. He's the author of a number of books on business history. But I think there are four biographies, three published, which I think describe his position and give us an idea of where he stands. These four biographies, he tells me, where his proposal was to write on four historic catastrophes. The first, James I, the second, Robespierre, the third, on the six well-meaning New Englanders who supplied the arms and money to John Brown, and the fourth on Woodrow Wilson. The Woodrow Wilson book is still in preparation. With this, I think we have some idea of where Mr. Scott stands. He's then our next speaker.
I prefer to stand so that I can run quickly. Webster defines culture as a variation of the verb to cultivate. And since the topic I was given was conservative culture, I think we should take a look at what in the United States is being cultivated. In our government schools, which we persist in calling public, the students are taught that society is governed by something called progress. And society is rather loosely defined as a community. But Durkheim, the father of sociology, believed that a society is formed by a religion. In fact, it was his opinion that without the sharing of certain principles and beliefs, there is no such thing as a society. And according to that theory, changes in religion mean a change in value. Weber, as you know, carried this assumption a step further. He credited the Calvinists with baptizing all society and expanding the idea of worship into every aspect of work. Of course, he was immediately attacked for this by people who have no particular faith, and of course the Calvinists have the worst press of any group since the Nazis. But at any rate, it is now a sort of tacit accepted principle in sociology and in history that intangible influences do affect society. In that sense, the logical positivists have lost the dialogue. And with this in mind, let's look around at us today, at the West. The change in the West has been so large that it has practically escaped general observation. We see a civilization which operated upon certain assumptions for something like 18 centuries, and then in a single 100-year span, dropped almost all those assumptions and is walking in a different direction. Now, if this sort of abrupt and widespread change had taken place in any other civilization, all our scholars would have run to find out what happened. But since it happened here, we're simply told that it happened because of progress. What progress? We take a look at it and it hurts our eyes. 100 years ago, the West ruled the world. Its principles prevailed in economics and politics, although, of course, the seeds of decay were evident in the 1880s. In retrospect, we look at Mr. Darwin's book in 1859, The Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That was the full title. It introduced a rationale for the superiority of some races and an argument against traditional religious beliefs in terms of creation. This created a great deal of mischief, but the modern educator draws a veil over that and keeps what's most palatable about Mr. Darwin's argument. Without that veil, the Darwinian defense might be a little more difficult. But mainly, he expressed ideas that were floating in the air in his day. And some of those ideas are only recently beginning to be analyzed. For instance, Martin J. Weiner of Rice University has just produced a very interesting book called The Decline of the Industrial Spirit in English Culture, 1850 to 1900. The English disdain for trade and commerce, which lured the English manufacturers and merchants into abandoning these efforts in an attempt to join the aristocracy, which fascinated that society, to become landed gentry, perhaps to become peers. I think in the instance of the petroleum industry, the founder of the Royal Dutch Shell, Samuel Marcus, became more interested in becoming Lord Mayor of London than he did in keeping the company together, so Detterding took it away from him. And one of the things that happened in the course of this progression was that England's agriculture lost the ability to feed its population by the year 1900. And I mention these facts not to concentrate on Britain, but to bring some parallels to our mind. The Atlantic Monthly April issue had an interesting article by Robert Reich on how American heavy industry fell from the top of the pole to somewhere in the middle or maybe lower. Reich describes how Detroit and other industrial centers basked in profits in the mid-50s, but refused to expand their operations. They refused to retool, to take the time out, to make heavy investments to keep up with new trends. Now, the shift was masked by creative accounting, by mergers instead of internal growth, and by a large and elaborate system of government subsidies. In both these instances of industrial decline, Britain's in the end of the last century and our own the last generation, I think it's safe to say that they are the result of certain shifts in fundamental values. Where at one time the ethic was to sacrifice the present advantage for a future goal, we now operate on a short-range basis. In the United States today, in business, the bottom line is publicly examined every 3 months. That doesn't allow for sacrifices of profits or dividends for retooling. In both nations, however, and throughout the West, it's fairly evident that large sectors of the management class have lost faith in the traditional system and turned toward their governments to keep afloat. And in every nation in the West, the governments have responded and stepped in to help them out. Our government is no exception to this. Subsidies to industry in this country are shrouded. At least the British are open about their nationalizations. Our approach is more covert. But that great change reflects a very serious change in values. Now, the meaning of Britain's industrial decline in the period from 1880, let's say, 1870, 1880, to 1914 meant that in World War I it was unable to fight a major war without our help. And what was true in the First War was even more true in the Second. But there was another element involved, and that was the general secularization of the West as a whole, which became very evident in the First War. In any previous period, governments that had sent millions of men to their death for undefined goals would have been thrown out and probably executed for crimes against the people. Yet the people of the West put up with this in World War I. There was a sort of a polite little uprising in Russia, which led to Kerensky's interim government, and then the Russians were suppressed again by a regime more brutal than before. This event so shocked Professor Toynbee that he compared it to the Peloponnesian War of ancient Greece, and he launched his histories to determine why civilization rise and fall. He decided that it was religion. No civilization can survive or does survive, he says, the loss of religion. He was attacked for this by people who had no religion. In the Second War, the behavior of the West was even worse. The English introduced mass bombings, and we exceeded them. In the USSR, pagans ruled. Carl Wittfogel made a study of this. A very interesting man in the context of a discussion of culture. He was a Marxist who changed his mind in the concentration camp. Quote, "My final thoughts go to those who, like myself, were passing through that great inferno of terror. Among them, some hoped for a great turning of the tables, which would make them guards and masters, where formerly they had been inmates and prisoners. They objected not to the totalitarian means, but to the ends for which they were being used. Others responded differently. They asked me if opportunity offered to explain to all who would listen the inhumanity of totalitarian rule in any form." End quote. Wittfogel survived, and he began to study the origins of totalitarianism. And he explained how the vast public monuments and immense irrigation systems of Mesopotamia and the Orient and Central and South America were the results of total despotism, in which vast numbers were forced to toil upon projects that were too large for individual efforts. And by irrigation, the government controlled agriculture, so they controlled both food and people. There were no classes in this system, because even those that were raised to a position of eminence by the despot could be brought down overnight. There was only one man on top. Everyone else was part of what Spengler called the fellaheen. The class system emerged in Greece, and there Wittfogel stopped. In the West, from Greece onward, despots were restrained by the nobility, and the nobility was sustained by the Christian idea that only God is sovereign, and that all power on earth must be limited. Thus, the nobles had a rationale in their struggle against the monarch. Now, it's obvious to me that Wittfogel demolished the idea that the class struggle is the key to history. The absence of the class struggle, he made clear, is the gateway to despotism. Nevertheless, our schools continue to discuss Marxism as though its rhetoric is serious, and conservatives in general, although sympathetic to the idea of elites, have failed to provide a popular defense of why elites are necessary and how they preserve liberty. Conservative culture has instead been apt to focus upon the surface of events, and especially upon politics. It has neglected the arts. In this gathering today, there's not a single painter, so far as I know. No composers, so far as I know. No dancers, no playwrights, nobody from the theater. In many respects, therefore, the conservative movement strikes me as an intellectual cottage industry. Each of these cottages is intent upon weaving its own tapestry, its own tartan, so to speak, just as determinedly as the weavers in the Hebrides. Most of these cottages are devoted to political issues. Well, some favor the economic. But even these are apt to discuss economics in terms that are, strictly speaking, no longer contemporary. This is not an open market system. It's not capitalism. It hasn't been for a long time. By fostering an alternative to capitalism and by turning to alternatives to religion, the United States has placed itself in a very precarious position. What our loss of eminence, industrially speaking, means in terms of the world was very succinctly expressed a long time ago by William James. Every up-to-date dictionary, he wrote, should say that war and peace mean the same thing, now in posse, now in act two. It may even be reasonably said that intensely sharp, competitive preparation for war by the nation is the real war, permanent, unceasing, and that battles are only a sort of public verification of mastery gained during the peace interval. That's a pragmatic appraisal. What James neglected to say, because in his day it was not yet apparent, was that when a people have no higher goals in life than comfort and security, they cease to think in terms of mastery and think only in terms of safety. And any nation that begins to shrink from challenge in the name of safety is already half defeated. One result is that the situation of the West has taken on some grotesque aspects. 10 years ago, Jean Raspail wrote a novel in France called The Camp of the Saints. Its thesis was that 1 million Hindu beggars somehow commandeered 100 steamers, managed to get them across the ocean to land on the shores of France, where they beached the vessels and the starving, filthy, ragged mass poured into the French landscape. Raspail believed 10 years ago that the French had become so sentimentalized that they would not be able to halt or repel such an invasion. I think he was right, and I think the history of the West in the years since his novel bear this out. Western Germany is having trouble with tens of thousands of Turks that invited in during a boom who are reluctant to leave during the bust. Britain, troubled by the presence of thousands of Hindus and Jamaicans, has now established three categories of citizenship. The third category is represented by former colonials in, say, Hong Kong, who may continue to hold British passports but will not be able to take them into Britain. The second category restricts the possibility of new citizenship. A top category of citizenship is reserved for the traditional English population. Not much has been said about this in our media. For our media screens a lot of news which the liberals feel we shouldn't know about. This is a variation, of course, of the intellectual Iron Curtain maintained in the Soviet bloc, which similarly screens world events. The difference in technique is striking. The difference in essence is somewhat less striking. Meanwhile, our lack of control over our borders is bringing Raspail's nightmare a bit closer. 100 million people live between here and Panama. If that area is communized in the near future, which seems fairly likely, we can add at least another 10 million to the 10 million or so unauthorized persons already living within our borders. Congress recently shouted down as racist a measure to restrict immigration. It's now preparing to accept with a shrug of the shoulders those who succeeded in evading our laws long enough to get here. And I'm sure you realize that that sort of encouragement will increase the tide. Meanwhile, we look about at the Bauhaus architecture, skeleton buildings, where we once imported cars, we now export porno. Where we once imported books and art, we import cocaine and heroin. In the midst of this shambles, the conservatives, in my opinion, have behaved heroically. But actually, our numbers are rather few. Our influence is indirect. It's impressive in view of the small numbers and the high level of articulation, but we cannot yet say that conservatism is a movement. In my opinion, we're hobbled to an extent by over-intellectuality and a persistent neglect of the arts by which large numbers of people are moved. Let me remind you that after the Soviets lost faith in the belief that the Germans would join their revolution, they sent a handful of agents into Germany. And they worked with artists, musicians, actors, painters, and playwrights. And the results are still visible even here in America, 60 years later. In the tiny town of Murphy, where I live in Northern California, the Black Bart Play Company is putting on the Three Penny Opera. Within 3 years after the Comintern sent a handful of people into Germany, most of the major German artists had been enlisted emotionally into the Marxist mainstream. Meanwhile, some idea of the remote position of the conservatives can be gained, at least was clear to me, by a remark made by a Southern poet at one of our regional meetings in New Orleans a few years back. He said, "I never heard of a Gnostic before I attended this meeting, but I can say now that if I see one coming, I'll duck." Now, with all the friendliness at my command, I'd like to suggest that the situation confronting us is a bit more urgent than what he learned. A few months ago, I was in South Africa, where they've stockpiled 3 years' supply of food and 3 years' supply of oil. Practically all the world's military experts say that the control of South Africa commands the South Atlantic, and both our industry and military is vitally dependent upon South African metals. But both the South Africans and we know that if that crunch comes, we will not help the South Africans, even though their fall might mean our doom. The major reason for this weird form of national suicide is the remarkable effectiveness of racial politics, which has now developed into an intellectual inhibitor which prevents honest reportage, honest literature, open discussion, courageous action. One British journalist mentioned the phenomenon in Britain at the New Orleans meeting. She said the cause of racial harmony takes precedence over freedom of speech in England today. And her words fell into silence. We're in the same situation, and I know of no journalist with her courage and candor in our ranks. Dr. Thomas Sowell and Dr. Walter Williams have taken up this subject. They've been maligned for their efforts. Not too many have appeared to stand beside them. Yet this is an area where conservatives really should get active. Our problem speaking as a conservative is in making clear what we believe should be conserved and what changes should be accepted. We're in the midst of changes ushered in by non-conservatives, changes many of us resent and fear. Yet there is no consensus, so far as I know, regarding which of these are inevitable and which must be resisted forever. It's clear, I believe, that we're living at a time when religious counterfeits abound, when faith in the major religions, Judaism and Christianity, are declining and being replaced by faith in something else. Because the human condition makes everybody a believer in something. The most popular substitute for God today is the government. Our government is no exception. People expect it to relieve the misery of their unemployment, to force their neighbors to accept them and to like them, to order their lives in safety from shock, misery, distress, fear. These are things which not even God promised to do on earth. Unfortunately, from my vantage, the conservative spends more time monitoring the government than it does over these other areas. By insensible stages, it seems to me, conservatism has grown into a political movement. It's not only a political movement, but a movement within the political stream, the political mainstream at this point. Now, this is undoubtedly a great accomplishment. But we may be overlooking some deeper problems. For instance, most Americans now fear the government, its powerful agencies, its unpredictable courts, its inquisitorial IRS, have rendered all our lives uncertain. We are told we must vote better people into office, but suppose there are no better people, then what? Suppose the debacle so often predicted, unless we change our ways as a nation, actually occur, then what? What is the conservative position? Can we think about changes? Could we consider that it's possible not that we need a new administration, but a new government? Our forebears didn't try to reform George III. They replaced him. I don't mean the present administration should be put into the same bracket, of course. But fundamentally, it has not been able to change the trends that alarm us, nor do I think it shall. The president has no party. Democrats and Republicans alike vie for the approval of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Therefore, if we want a conservative culture, we shall have to think in deeper and braver terms about how to bring such a culture into life. We shall have to downplay commenting on others and start thinking for ourselves. Stop talking mainly to each other and recruit the communicators of art and expression. Stop the racists by challenging their campaigns of fear and blackmail. And drop those who would use this cause as a political springboard. We should broaden our activities, in my opinion, to encompass not just politics and economics and the academy, but the whole of American life. If there is ever to be a conservative culture, we must cultivate one. Thank you.